Turn in your Bibles to the book Philippians. If you think you're on Mars Hill today waiting to hear some great and new thing, you'll be disappointed. If you think you're in a cornfield, we may just shuck together. There is, in the Epistle to the Philippians, magnificent grandeur. I don't think there's a more resplendent passage in all the Pauline corpus than, "Wherefore God hath also highly exalted him, and given him a name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow and every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." But I think sometimes we in particular, who are always looking for theology in our expositions of Holy Scripture, and theology becomes the thing, and in a way theology is the thing, but there are tangential issues in epistles which, if we're not careful, our penchant for theology will cause us to overlook. And we'll miss some of the practical import, which may not be explicitly stated. There's much explicit statement of practicality in the writings of Paul, but there are implicit doctrines of practicality which the speedy eye will miss when reading the text. And it's some of those more subtle elements of this epistle that I want to address with you today. Now, I don't want to denigrate the beauty, integrity, and reverence of the gospel by putting a flippant title on a sermon. But Paul Moffat is always asking me for sermon titles. So Paul, if you're up there, here it is. How goes it? How goes it? You all know what that means. If I saw you on the street or out in the parking lot and said, "How goes it?" you know exactly what I mean. It's a three-word question that resonates with other questions we ask in our culture. Some of you have seen the television commercial, the New York guys sitting in the bar, and one guy comes in, another guy comes in, another guy comes in and says, "How you doing? How you doing?" I can't say it like they say it. And then finally there's a commercial where they have this Texan and they ask him, "How you doing?" And he goes on about a 2-minute spiel of how he's doing. Sort of funny. In his song Positively, 4th Street, Bob Dylan has one of my favorite lines in his writings. "You see me on the street, you always act surprised. You say, 'How are you? Good luck,' but you don't mean it." I think sometimes we do say, "How you doing?" or "How are you?" without thinking. You've heard me talk about that before. But how's it going? We generally don't say that too much. They may say that in East Texas. "How's it going?" or "How goes it?" But in Dallas, we're a little more sophisticated than that. How goes it? When Trey was a little boy, he went to a nursing home with his grandfather, and Trey has a vivid memory of an experience he had in that nursing home. Dr. Sessions, you could probably explain to us what happens to the vocal cords as people get older. I presume it has something to do with the aging of tissue and perhaps the lessening amount of fluids to the vocal cords, but the voices of old people tend to become a little gruff, don't they? And you notice it more in older women, really old women. And Trey, when a little boy, walked into a nursing home with his grandfather, and this very old woman in a wheelchair, not even looking up, said, "How you doing?" And Trey said, "I'm fine. How you doing?" She said, "I'm doing pretty good. How you doing?" It's just a ping pong effect that we have. Well, odd text, and odd that this text would strike me, is the text in which Paul talks about how goes it. Now, we have a couple of cursory humorous anecdotes that I've mentioned here, not merely to make you laugh, but to make you think about the theme. But if we could get beneath the surface of the question, how goes it? And I could really scratch the soil of your soul and use the spade to dig a little more deeply into your life and ask you this very serious, meaningful question. How's it going? How's it going? And you would assert your soul and give me a thoughtful, careful, cautious, deliberate response. How's it going? Then I think some of our laughter might turn into tears or bursts. And maybe everything's perfect in your life. And maybe if I said, "How goes it?" You said, "Great." Just heard a Zig Ziglar tape. Maybe that's the way it is, but I guarantee you, soul, friend, Christian brother or sister, if you're having a Zig Ziglar moment, you'll have a Job hour. Man that is born of woman is of a few days and full of trouble. Even in the epistle to the Philippians, Paul said in 1:29, it is given to you on behalf of Christ not only to believe on Him, but also to suffer for His sake. And you know that the idea of suffering as part and parcel to the Christian life, real suffering, real burden, real heaviness, real sorrow, real heartbreak, those are things that modern Arminianism preempts from the normal Christian life. Tragedy, burden, crisis are the exceptions rather than the rule. But Jesus said something about taking up a cross daily, and already mentioned Job, and the words of Jesus Himself, "In this world ye shall," very emphatic, imperative, "you shall have tribulation." So, at the risk of being called a prophet in dark clothing with a foreboding tone, when I say, "How goes it?" I'm not looking for a flippant answer. I'm looking for a serious soul reflection from you. Not that you have to tell me, but you do have to do a personal inventory of how it's going. Now, I suppose if I could simplify this, I would say, well, what's wrong? Is there anything wrong? And you can begin to make a list of things that are wrong. Well, there's something it's bothering me about my husband. Yesterday, Judy said, "Hal, what is it with you and your socks?" You know, this has been 30 years. And that's, so finally she asked. Just out of the blue, I wasn't expecting it. Boy, if the socks are the only thing wrong with your marriage, you're blessed. But it may be something wrong with your marriage. Maybe something wrong with your job. There may be something wrong with your children. There may be something wrong with your mind, your attitude, your heart, your moral life. And I know that if we can break the bubble of falsified reality in which we live in North Dallas and really get to the root and ground of living and life, that there are burdens here. There's something wrong. And you know, dear saints of God, for some of you, this may be a prospective sermon. Just one for the future. For the prospect of how's it going in the future. Maybe one person here today for whom this right now is very, very important. So when I say how goes it, I don't mean to be flippant. I just want to know. You don't have to tell me, but it seems that the Lord is asking a searching question through this text. Now, here's how I came upon this text. If you look at Philippians chapter 2, verse 19, Paul is writing to this church whom you know he loves. It's the only epistle in which he writes where he doesn't identify himself in his introduction as an apostle. And I find that very interesting because Paul had such a relationship with the Philippians, he didn't need to legitimize his credentials with them. He doesn't say Paul an apostle, he just says Paul a servant, Paul a bondslave. And there is debate about whether or not Paul is imprisoned in Ephesus or Rome at this time. Most scholars believe he is imprisoned in Rome. And as you know, the imprisonment was a real imprisonment. The imprisonment at Ephesus may have been more difficult, but it was not more dangerous. Both imprisonments could have become deadly, fatal encounters with political powers. Is a real imprisonment, whether it occurs in Rome or Ephesus, probably Rome. And so his heart is really longing to see these Philippians. I can't imagine how that must have been from Paul, having the fresh message of the gospel, the resurrection of Jesus Christ on his heart and mind, having preached that passionately, having seen scores, even hundreds of people converted and numerous churches established, and then being in prison and not being able to see any of them personally. How much that have broken his heart. He's got great hope, and he says in verse 19, I trust in the Lord Jesus to send Timotheus shortly unto you, that I also may be of good comfort when I know your state. For I have no man like-minded who will naturally care for your state. For all seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ's. But you know the proof of him, that as a son with the Father, he hath served with me in the gospel. Him, therefore, I hope to send presently, watch, so soon as I shall see how it will go with me. But I trust in the Lord, that I also myself shall come shortly. We'll look up that word for trust in verse 24. It's the idea of being fully persuaded. Paul had a confidence he would go to Philippi. It couldn't be an absolute confidence, but it was certainly complete in hope. He really wanted to go himself, but he couldn't. Thus he was sending Timothy. But you see the interesting phrase and turn of words in verse 23. Him therefore I hope to send presently, so soon as I shall see how it will go with me. That passage just struck me. Very unusual that we would highlight that passage in our worship today. Well, Paul's actually writing this epistle, perhaps in a cell, at least under the immediate governance of a Roman guard, very possibly actually chained. And he says, I'm going to send Timothy, and we'll see how it goes with me. I wonder what Paul was processing mentally when he wrote that. As soon as we shall see how it will go with me. Well, I know exactly what he was processing, at least to a degree. One, he was processing the reality of real imprisonment in his immediate future. We shouldn't forget that in the sovereign providence of God, this miracle of irony occurs, in which the man to whom God has given the gospel of free grace is chained. It's a magnificent providential irony. Yet we should not forget that there must have been not only a real physical difficulty that attenuated Paul's circumstances with chains, and we think that in Ephesus he was in horrific prison circumstances, perhaps in a dungeon-like prison with filth and wetness and darkness at all times. That's why Paul was facing when he said, I'll have to see how it goes. It may not have been so difficult at Rome, but it was difficult nonetheless. Another thing I know that he was contemplating when he says, let me see how it goes with me, is the real possibility of execution. Well, this was no joke, this is no myth, this is no fairy tale, no story, no imaginary circumstance. Paul is in prison and he might really die. If you were looking at this from a distance, thinking about this preacher in trouble with the law. By the way, we know from his epistle to the Philippians that the Jews had followed him to Rome or Ephesus or wherever he was at this time and continued to buffet at him as they had buffeted at Christ, even calling for his execution. And if not by the authorities, they had in fact inspired to kill Paul, and on one occasion left him stoned, they thought, to dead, unconscious, outside a city. When Paul says, let me see how it goes, it's really a heavy thing. Heavy because of Paul's continuing imprisonment. Heavy because there was the real possibility that he would face death by execution. How goes it with you? What are you facing? What is the burden? What is the circumstance? Now, all kinds of silly, superficial, practical applications I can make here. Well, get over it. Your circumstance is not as bad as Paul. You're not in prison. You're not facing execution. But for more of us than fewer, I would suspect, there is some real burden that is attending your life right now. So beneath the surface, when I ask the question, how goes it? Can you answer that? What's the burden? And this is Paul's own problem. I'll have to see, dear Philippians, how it goes with me. Now, in the context of Philippians, there are other burdens with which Paul was dealing besides the burden of imprisonment and the burden of impending death. And I have a hunch that some of the burdens you are facing are parallel to the burdens which Paul faced as he wrote this epistle, and you might overlook the connection between you and Paul if you're just looking for high theology or explicit doctrine. All of you have to deal with people through the week, is that right? You know, life would be great if it weren't for people. Right? Life would be great if it weren't for people and the problems they bring. Well, think about, and I would imagine that when I scratch the surface of your soul, and hopefully the Spirit of the Lord goes a little more deeply than I, and I say, how goes it? No, really, how goes it? I would imagine, in fact, I'm sure that whatever that problem is that you have has to do with someone. Maybe yourself. And very possibly other folks. Well, Paul didn't live in a vacuum. He had to deal with people too, and people were the source of Paul's problems more than anything else. And one of the problems that Paul faced, and some of you are note takers, so here's the point, is that he was surrounded by people with questionable motivations, some of whom were out to get him. Did you ever feel that way? That there was a little pocket or a nucleus or a group of people, maybe one person, a Judas perhaps, a Shimei. Remember Shimei in the story of David, always throwing stones at David. One day I'm going to do a sermon on the Shimei syndrome. It seems God sends us Shimeis, people who are always walking along by our river course and path of life and following us and just mocking us and saying things to us to aggravate us and picking up stones and throwing. Do you have anybody like that? Anybody you work with? Anybody in your family like that? Hopefully you're not a Shimei. Shimei is the Hebrew word for jerk. Paul was surrounded by people with questionable motivations. Look at chapter 1, verses 15 through 17. Some indeed preach Christ even of envy and strife, and some also of goodwill. The one preached Christ of contention, not sincerely supposing to add affliction to my bonds, but the other of love, knowing that I am set for the defense of the gospel. Well, quite frankly, everyone around you has mixed motives. Some motives are good, some motives are bad. And if you haven't met Shimei yet, if you haven't met Judas yet, you will. And hopefully you'll know them before they have a chance to kiss you or stone you. Hopefully you'll recognize Shimei at least by the time he picks up the rock. Or Judas, at least by the time he reaches for you. How's it going? Are there people around you with questionable motives, taking detrimental action towards you? That was really what was happening to Paul. In his immediate circumstances, he was not just facing continued imprisonment and the possibility of death by execution, but he was in a vortex of relationships with people of questionable motives. Secondly, or thirdly, or fourthly, he was having to deal with conflict resolution with people. Well, I said earlier, life would be great if it weren't for people. One of the curses upon Adam is that he has to deal with other fallen human beings beside himself. That's why we have wars and rumors of wars, nation rising against nation. That's why the Arabs hate the Jews. That's why some blacks hate some whites and some whites hate some blacks. That's why people and families can't get along. That's why marriages break down. That's why there's a sword between a mother and a daughter and a father and a son. That's why a man's enemies can be they of his own household. Because in our fallen nature, we are inevitably destined to conflict. Our confession of faith suggests that we are biased toward evil. We are predisposed to do that which is wrong. And it's never more bitter, never more burdensome than when you have a conflict with another human being. I despise that. Working in Christian schools, as I have as a headmaster, conflict resolution is a huge part of my job. And it is very unpleasant when a parent is at odds with the teacher. Usually more unpleasant, Rhonda and Medina, for the teacher than for the parent, much more usually. It's very uncomfortable when a student is at odds with a student or at odds with a teacher or a faculty member at a faculty member or a board member at a faculty member. Very difficult. And I'm sure in other professions there's conflict. Jansen, I don't know how often in your dental office conflict arises. Or Cindy, I'm sure there are conflicts over bills of people who owe you money. Conflict, conflict, conflict. Man that is born of woman is of a few days and full of trouble as the sparks fly upward. Conflict. Take one granite head and one flint head, and you got sparks. How's it going? How you doing? How goes it? You got any conflict? Especially with other people. Or, maybe worse, do you have it in here? Man, it's one thing to be knotted up with somebody else. It's another thing altogether to be knotted up on the inside yourself. Now, when I have conflict with other people, I get knotted up. Do you? Sure. Sure. When I have conflict with other people, I get knotted with them. It knots me. But you can not be knotted up with other people in conflict with them, but somehow have internal conflict yourself and being all gutted up, knotted up on the inside. So how is it going? Well, we refer to Philippians as the epistle of joy. And over again in this lovely, beautiful, gracious, sweet epistle to this church, who was at one time in Paul's ministry the only church supporting him, right? We rejoice in this epistle. We rejoice, and as Paul said, rejoice, again I say, rejoice. The peace of God shall keep your hearts and minds. God shall supply all your needs according to His riches in glory. We rejoice in epistle to the Philippians. But there is in Philippians evidence of conflict in the church. You see this in chapter 1 and chapter 4 especially, and hinted in chapter 2. In chapter 1, listen to what Paul says. Only let your conversation be as it becometh the gospel of Christ, that whether I come and see you or else be absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. The first hint in Philippians that there might be something wrong at Philippi. You see it again in chapter 2. If there be any fellowship of the Spirit, any comfort of love, any bowels of mercy, fulfill ye my joy that you be like-minded, being of the same love one to another. Let nothing be done through strife and vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem the other better than themselves. I'll tell you this, as sort of an editorial here, ain't no trouble like church trouble. I like to be a lamb, but goodness, try to cause any trouble here and the lion of the tribe of Judah will rise. We don't want any conflict. And at Philippi, there were two sizzling sisters who apparently, if not the source of the broader problem in the church, were at least their own problem. Paul said, I beseech Euodias and Syntyche that they be of the same mind in the Lord. You two women that are fussing, get it fixed. But my point's not what was wrong at Philippi. My point is, how's it going in your Philippi? How's it going with your Euodias? How goes it with your Syntyche? How goes it in your professional or familial relationships with other human beings, your fellow workers, your children, your husband, your wife? Are you in conflict? Well, Paul was. There he was in prison, facing future imprisonment, maybe death, in a vortex of people, some of whose motives were questionable. And on top of that, he was having to deal with conflict. Sound like life? It's right there in the book. Right there in the book. And still, I'm amazed at Paul and how spiritually and psychologically composed he was in the context of that difficulty. Here's another thing that he had to face, and that was selfishness. Chapter 2, verse 21, all seek their own, not the things which are Christ's. In his work on the Ten Commandments, A.W. Pink rightly points out that covetousness is the root of all evil. He's not contradicting Paul for the love of money, but when you look at the Ten Commandments vertically, as opposed to merely numerically, the foundation of the Ten is the tenth. It's here. And what is it? It's thou shalt not covet. You see, covetousness informs and influences and is the essence of all the other sins which violate all the other commandments. If you are in violation of commandment one, thou shalt love the Lord thy God, it is because you covet something other than that which rightly belongs to God. If you're in violation of commandment 2 or commandment 3 or commandment 4, it's you covet. You want something for yourself. You don't want to honor your father and mother. You don't want to keep the Sabbath day. You don't want to love your neighbor as yourself. You don't want to be selfless about that thing you desire. You might steal some way, like your taxes. You see, covetousness is the root of all evil. And isn't selfishness the root of covetousness? You see this in the Garden of Eden. What was it that motivated Adam and Eve to do wrong? It was self-interest. Now, the devil played on that propensity in their nature, which had to exist before they could enter into the temptation. But Eve desired something for herself. Something which had been forbidden, but something for herself which she thought was in her self-interest to possess. And it got her in trouble. Then Adam came along. He wasn't too interested in the apple, but he was interested in Eve. And it was more out of his covetousness of her than out of his covetousness for the apple. He chose to ally himself with her actions. Lucifer, in seeking to steal the glory of God. Jesus said, if any man would follow me, let him what? Deny himself. Now, Christianity isn't self-abnegation, but it is self-humiliation. Let him deny himself. And the antithesis of selfishness is self-denial. And that's what Christianity is really about. Denying oneself, taking up a cross, and following Christ. The problem is, human beings are geared exactly opposite to that. It is so difficult to be saved in a capitalist society. It is so difficult to be saved in a Republican democracy. It is so difficult to be saved in a culture of success. It is so difficult, Rachel, Alethea, Luke, it is so difficult, Joel, where are you, son? It's so difficult for a teenager to be saved. So hard. So very hard. Especially in this culture. Because everything around us is about wanting and getting and possessing. And the essence of Christianity is contrary to that. How's it going? How's it going with you in your attitude towards selfishness? And what about the problems that you're facing with other people in your life? How many of those problems stem because someone else is being selfish? Probably all of them. Paul was facing the same problem. Here's another practical thing. And this is for me and for some of you. Miss Beth, several months ago, called me up. Said, Hal, I got a verse for you. I said, okay. Philippians chapter 2, verses 25 through 27. And Tim Weber, would you rise and face the congregation and read those for me? Philippians chapter 2, verses 25 through 27. How's it going?
My brother and fellow worker and fellow soldier, who is also your messenger and minister to my need, because he was longing for you all and was distressed because you had heard that he was sick. For indeed he was sick to the point of death, but God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but also on me, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow.
Miss Beth just said, the Lord's not going to let you have sorrow upon sorrow. Now, you can be sure that you're going to get sick. Let me just repeat that. You can be sure that you're going to get sick. And I will go a step further. You can be sure that you're going to get very sick. Now, you don't believe that. Now, you may believe it here, but you don't have it in your gut. Rhonda and Medina, am I incorrect? This very recently in Trinity, two young women have been pronounced with breast cancer there. Just like that. One of them, a bright, healthy, athletic, beautiful young woman who's a coach there. Got to have a double mastectomy. I forget what the percentages are about breast cancer, how many young women will get it, or older women. And there are other means and causes of death, but I want to tell you, you are going to get very sick. Every one of you, barring the Lord's return. Before that, you're going to get sick. Or, before you get very sick. Well, I'm just talking to you in the cornfield now. You better hear it. Before you get very sick, someone you love is going to get very sick. Now that is an absolute inevitability. It will come. Grady, how would you feel if Rhonda got very sick? You know, every man in here would want himself to be sick before his wife. I've told Judy many times, if I could do this for you, I would. It's no hero thing. It's just, if you'd love your wife as Christ loved the church, you'd lay down your life for her, right? Grady, what if? And it might happen. Rhonda, I hope not, dear. Laura, what if Matthew, as young as he is, got very sick? Or, Michelle, what if David is killed on the job? He's in a very dangerous profession as a firefighter, paramedic. Well, I want to tell you, inevitably, one day, somebody you love is going to be very sick, or you're going to be very sick. Somebody's going to say, how you doing? How goes it? And the heaviness of that question is going to settle on you in a way that never has. And young people, there you've heard, I'm going to shave pretty soon, Rachel, because this gray makes me look older. And when I say young people, they think, well, I'm one of them. But you're 16? 15. And Rhonda, she's about to get a driver's license. Grady, your insurance is about to go up. We may have to take a love offering. I'm 53. Seems like a long way away, doesn't it? Rachel, darling, it's not. I remember when I was 16. I was at Lowe's yesterday morning very early, and the checkout person made a joke with me about some glue sniffing stuff I was getting. It's called goof off or something like that. Apparently, it's very dangerous. She said, "May I see your ID?" Just kidding. And I said, well, I still feel 18. And I do. Life has wings. And they're not folded. Life has wings. And they're always spread full. And those spread full wings of life are always fast upon a swift wind. Your life is like a vapor in the sun. It's beautiful, radiates like a diamond, but it is so rapidly dissipating. Rachel, I remember the day you were born. It wasn't that long ago. You or somebody you love is going to get very sick. And in terms of the swiftness of time, very sick very soon. But if by the grace of God you know the Lord Jesus Christ, He says that God will have mercy upon you that you may not have sorrow upon sorrow. Isn't that a sweet thing? But it is inevitable. Now, I must hasten, but stay with me, please. These are important lessons from Paul. Sickness. What about uncertain economic circumstances? Some of you know that I follow the market very closely, and perhaps some of you follow the market very closely. The most fickle thing I know is the stock market. It is completely fickle. There's a poem by Alexander Pope, and in it, this quotation: "All things hiddenly connected are by almighty power near and far, so that you cannot touch a leaf without troubling a star." Let me repeat it. Oh, I don't believe it's true for a minute. In a way it is. I mean, there may be something to cosmic karma and all that, but it doesn't have to do with Vishnu, I assure you. Here's the poem. It's a beautiful thought. "All things hiddenly connected are by almighty power near and far, so that you cannot touch a leaf without troubling a star." It's really a deistic idea, but it does apply to the stock market. Alan Greenspan can touch a leaf and it's fall in the stock market. Or he can plant a seed and it's spring. The ancients, pre-deists, believed in what was called the Wheel of Fortune. There's an American game show that sort of denigrated the idea of the Wheel of Fortune. But in ancient cultures, particularly fatalistic cultures such as some of the Greeks, the Stoics in particular, there was the idea that you were upon a wheel of fortune and it was always turning. And just like our clock, you know, sometimes you're up and sometimes you're down. And since it's always turning, you are going to be up and you are going to be down. Sounds like the stock market or your mutual fund over the last 3 or 4 years, right? So if you had to put yourself on the wheel of fortune right now, where would it be? Are you about here? Probably not. Probably about right here or maybe right here. You know, how certain is that? How certain is financial stability? Not very. Not very at all. And really, let me make a point here to a rather affluent group of people. When you have confidence in your financial ability, you are in trouble, brother. I really mean that. When financial stability gives you sort of fixity of peace of mind, you're in trouble. Because there are 10,000 ways that the Lord could get your attention through money. 10,000 ways. Now that was a reality for Paul. As I said earlier, right, this epistle divulges that at one point in Paul's ministry, in the King James language, no church communicated with me concerning giving and receiving except you. He was in prison. He was chained. He was facing death. People around him were in conflict, some of whom had very dangerous motivations against him. Epaphroditus was sick and it was breaking Paul's heart. People were acting selfishly all about him. And on top of that, money was a problem. Money was a problem. And if you have any money problems, I would have the hunch that even some of you with the highest incomes probably don't think you have quite enough money. what is enough? If you've ever read The Rocking Horse Winter by D.H. Lawrence, where the little boy goes mad because he continually hears his mother and father talking about, we've got to have more money, there must be more money, and finally the walls begin to whisper it to the child, and the ceiling begins to whisper it, and he hears it all around, and he begins to rock on his horse, and rock on his horse, and his eyes turn like blue sapphires and radiate with a hellish light. And he says, there must be more money, there must be more money, there must be more money, there must be more money. They that trust in riches, Paul said, err from the faith and pierce themselves through with many sorrows. How's it going about money? How's it going about money? Are you worrying about it too much? Are you thinking about it too much? Do you have a problem with it? Can you not handle it? Are you in serious trouble with it? Paul faced that as well. So how goes it? Hey, I don't have any solutions to your money problem. Work. That's your solution. Get to work. Put your hand on the plow and don't look back. Be due diligent. Hey, I've got another suggestion for you. Pay your tithe. If you're not tithing, you're a thief. You're robbing God of what is His. Pay your tithe and He'll open the windows of heaven, pour you out a blessing, there won't be room enough to receive it. But you know, it's pretty interesting in this culture how the Lord can get our heart's attentions through pocketbook. I'll tell you this about money. Don't trust in it. Don't lust after it. Two great evils. How goes it? How goes it? I'll send Epaphroditus, or rather Timothy, as soon as I shall see how it will go with me. Questionable motives of those around you, context of conflict, selfishness, your own or others, sickness, difficult economic circumstances. Let's stand together. Paul was a real man who lived in a real world dealing with real people who had real problems, and he had real problems of his own. But isn't it interesting? You know, this is a pretty depressing sermon. And you thought Philippians was a happy book. Isn't it interesting that when you start looking in Philippians, there were real problems that Paul faced, the people he knew faced, that the church at Philippi faced. But isn't it interesting that Paul, in the middle of that, said this? And I bet you can quote it. And really, here's the message. I have learned that whatsoever state I'm in, therewith to be content. Content. What are images of contentment? A placid lake, like a mirror, still waters of the soul that's seeing it is well, it is well, it is well. This contentment, complete equipoise of emotions, complete peace of mind. It really is. And there this old preacher was in the midst of all these problems, said, well, here's what I've learned. And wouldn't you like to learn this lesson? And you know what, Christians, we are supposed to learn it. I've learned that whatsoever state I am in, therewith to be content. Well, if you have the grace of God, you will gradually learn that lesson. So you got problems? Okay, you're gonna have problems. You're gonna have more and worse problems. Let me say that again. It is true. You will have more and worse problems. But you need to learn how to avail yourself of the grace of God. And learn with Paul, no matter what your circumstances, they're in, to be content. May we pray. Our Father, I don't know what burdens and problems face people in our congregation, but we do know some of the problems that Paul faced, and they must resonate with the real experiences of our life. And Father, in those, help us to see that we are not remotely unique in the burdens we face, but they're common to all humanity, even to the mightiest of Christians as Paul. And in our realization that we are born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward, help us to pause a moment with Paul in prison. Help us to survey the own imprisonment of our souls in this world, to see the conflict and selfishness and financial difficulties and adversities that face us, and ask ourselves, how did Paul have such peace in the middle of that, such contentment? And Lord, give us the answer over and over and over again, even if you must give us adversity for us to ask the question. Give us the answer that it's your grace alone, not only in our salvation, not only in our sanctification, but also in the equipoise of our souls. Your grace alone, in the eye of the storm, in the center of your will, that gives us the peace of God that passeth all understanding and that guards our hearts and minds through Jesus Christ. That's one other thing. You know that when Paul closed the letter to the Philippians, he said, "And may the peace of God that passeth all understanding," it's not keep, the Greek word guard. And you know that when Paul wrote that, "the peace of God that passeth all understanding shall guard your mind," you know there was a guard standing there. And you see that tension between looking at what's in this world and looking at what's in that world. And I would suspect you're looking at one of those two guards right now. You're looking at the Roman guard of this world, and therefore you're all worried and concerned about these things. Or you're looking at the heavenly guard of grace and the heavenly guard of peace. And I hope it's the latter. You're dismissed.